The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So good evening, and welcome to our last class in this mindfulness of introduction to mindfulness meditation. And before I start what I'm going to teach, I'm happy to take some questions, also some comments or reports with how it's going with meditating at home and such things. It's kind of nice for me to hear because I have a better sense of how maybe to teach and go forward. But does anybody have any questions or comments or reports? Testimonials, meditation testimonials. So straight in the back. You'd probably need to turn it on by pushing the button. In the middle, there's a button. There's a green light that goes on.
I am new to this, although I have been so grateful to be experiencing a very positive time with your online course. And so I have not been with this class, but I've elected to come to the last one because I have listened to it multiple times online.
The last class?
The last class.
Oh, the which pressure's has been on now.
So here I am. So that, yeah, good for that. But I am trying to put so much of it together with a personal health struggle that I've been having. And I want to thank you for making that available, number one. And number two, with the emphasis on breath, I have had a wonderful experience with something from my past. I'm from the East Coast and spent so many summers in the Atlantic Ocean. And for any of you that have been in the ocean for the you get to this exact perfect place with the rise and the fall where the waves don't come over you, but it. I have learned to use that for the in and the out, and at first I thought it was a distraction because it was visual, and then it became very fluid.
Nice.
And so for any of you that have been in the ocean, have had the fortune to be right where the water does that for you. You don't have to do anything. It carries you up, and it puts you down and carries you up. And so I didn't know if that was cheating because it's kind of visual, but not really. So is that cheating?
You know, thank you. That was great. And I'll use your question as a cheating as a stepping off point for a little teaching about how mindfulness works, and at least in our tradition and the Buddhist tradition. And that is that in the end, you're supposed to become your own teacher. You're supposed to, and you do become your own teacher through trial and error. And so what you're looking for is what is helpful. And so is it helpful for you to do that? And it sounds like it is. And if you understand how it's helpful, so you're a little bit more. You try to be a little more particular, rather than some, you know, vague idea. Oh, this feels good or something. Then you're also in a better position to know when it stops being helpful, or when you reach the limit of that helpfulness. And so, with that's a great kind of image or visualization of the waves. I did that. My son was young. I did that regularly with him as he went to sleep. I would do a kind of guided meditation and. Sometimes he was a otter, and up and down on the waves, and with his breaths, and so, maybe I was cheating, but he didn't know. And but as people get into the meditation and get kind of more focused, quieter, at some point the visualization is too much. At some point, the visualization gets in the way of a more intimate connection with the experience. So when that point comes. Because you're kind of you'll kind of know. It's kind of self-correcting. At some point, you'll know or you'll wonder, and at some point, maybe now I'll try not doing it and see what happens. But I think it's great. Another one that some people have used is they were an eagle in the sky, and their wings were outstretched, and they catch the updrafts, and they're kind of going up and down with the wings. And I've known people found that really compelling also for staying with the breathing. Last week we did mindfulness of thinking. Did some of you think enough that it was caused to bring your mindfulness to your thinking and to follow the instructions? Was that useful or interesting? And anything anybody want to say about that? Yes, and so Mike can go here to the front.
Well, I had a little trouble separating the thinking part from the being conscious of the fact that I am thinking, because the two seem to flow together quite a bit to me. To me,
so I think that,
you know, I mean, I was able to pull myself back to the breath, depending on how involved I got in the particular thought. But how can you be mindful of the fact you're thinking without
thinking,
understanding what you're thinking about? I guess is what my question is.
Oh, I see. How can you be mindful of thinking without knowing what you're thinking about? I think chances are it comes pretty natural to know what you're thinking about if you're mindful. But you don't have to be contemplating that. You don't have to, why am I thinking that, and where did it come from, and, you know, you don't have to think more just because you recognize it. It's just a very simple thing. You know, I'm thinking about the past. I'm thinking about X, I'm thinking about the future. And I think it's kind of pretty straightforward, and it's kind of an innocent thought to have, as opposed to a full-blown story and conclusions about life because you had a thought. So a very simple, innocent, oh yeah, I'm thinking about the past. And then you step back, and if thinking about the past continues, you step back in a sense, and then you kind of look at the ecology of that thinking process. And we're not less interested in the content as we are in the process of thinking, the ecology of thinking. So you might notice, for example, the physicality that comes along with thinking, or the emotionality that comes along with it. And that might, you know, help you not get swept away or caught in it.
I mean, and I was able to do that to some degree, but then I'd kind of vacillate between that and whatever I happened to be thinking about.
Of course.
Yeah,
of course, that's right. And so it's best with this kind of practice here to not have either or thinking, like I have to do it right or not. You know, it just sounds like you're going in the right direction. Do you find it helpful at times that you did step away from it and see it more clearly for what it was? So that's a victory. And then slowly you'll be able to do more of it and more of it, and it'll probably be very helpful. Maybe one more.
So I can tell you a little bit about my experience. So I've been practicing mindfulness of the body, especially with respect to my chest. And for the first time in my life, I was able to look back on myself. And that's never happened before. And this reminds me of the example you give, the cowherd example, that is kind of making sure the cows don't go into the neighbor farmer's pasture. And then at some point, after all the crops have been harvested, you don't really worry and you calm down, you get into a concentrated mode. Then the cowherd turns around and looks at you. So that's the feeling I got. And usually I'm the kind who's always running around. And after that, I was able to sit in a sofa for a half hour without feeling guilty.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so that's an achievement for me.
And your wife was happy with that?
I don't know.
You don't know. Good. Okay, great. Thank you for the comments. So So we're at the last class, and what I was hoping that these first four classes did was to give you, point you in the, to the idea that we're trying to learn how to be attentive in a wise way, be mindful, have a clear awareness of all aspects of our lived experience. Whatever we have the ability, anything that's in the lived present moment can be the subject of mindfulness. So it certainly can be the breathing or the body or emotions and thoughts. It could be sounds. It could be what you see in the world. You know, it's the whole, you know, the experience of the moment. And nothing is considered to be outside the scope of mindfulness in that if it's happening in the present moment, if it's a happening event, it's an occurrence, if you're experiencing it. And and one of the kind of principles of Buddhism, it's not articulated so clearly by the Buddha or other places, but that is that an awareness that can, in fact, knows how to include everything within it, borders on being sacred. The inclusive awareness that has no outside. There's nothing which is considered inappropriate or unacceptable to be known. When awareness can be inclusive of everything that occurs, not that you have to be aware of everything at once, but there's no barriers, no saying not that, or running away, or closing down, or ignoring, but there's a kind of openness, a willingness to have a certain kind of attention, awareness, that can include everything, that doesn't divide up our reality between, at least in terms of awareness, between our preferences, our bias, our expectations, our desires, our hates, and all that. But to really have this openness. And it's kind of like maybe going into a sacred building, maybe. And the walls are only doors, and they're all open. So there's nothing, there's no barriers, there's no... Nothing, kind of everything's included. There's a place for everything to come in. And what's so special about that, aside that we're not... The awareness itself, then, is not in conflict with anything. There could be things that appropriately you don't like, appropriately you think shouldn't happen, appropriately you might think that you wish it was differently. You might even work on trying to change some things in your life appropriately. That's, you know, that's all... You know, it depends on your wisdom to know what needs to be changed. But what you do and what you think and what you prefer is different than being aware of it, what's going on. And so even though you might have some things which are unacceptable, so, you know, you spill all your ketchup on the kitchen floor and, you know, you don't want anybody to step on it because it's going to track it all over the house, you'd probably prefer not to have that. And probably you'd get involved in cleaning up the floor. But your awareness doesn't have to get contracted. Your awareness doesn't have to turn away and say, I can't deal with that. Your awareness doesn't have to be tinged by anger or embarrassment or shame or, you know, all kinds of other things. The awareness somehow is like an open door, an open space in which you look down at the floor and there's this wonderful capacity just to see it and feel that some part of your mind or your heart is untroubled by what you see, is unruffled, doesn't get agitated. It's just, oh, look at that. There's space in my mind for that. And I'm going to clean it up. And, you know, this is not what I want. So you might be with a difficult situation at work that maybe is in some ways unacceptable. And you're going to do something about it. But you have the ability to be at rest with your awareness. So, oh, look at that. This is a situation that's not comfortable, it's not right. And again, the awareness doesn't get sticky. The awareness itself has space in it. There's a certain kind of calm or peace or spaciousness. Look at this. So the awareness is kind of free. And in that freedom, then there's greater capacity to maybe know what to do, maybe intuitively know what to do, than if we're immediately reactive and contracted around the situation. So I don't know if those examples are the best ones for you, but that's probably enough to kind of get the idea that there's something very special about the awareness that's different than all the other things that goes on inside, like the reactions and the beliefs and the preferences we have. So one of the things we can become aware of as we begin being more mindful is, in fact, the preferences we have, the biases we have, the expectations we have, the agendas we have, the beliefs we have in relationship to what's happening. And to see those clearly means that we have some choice about whether or not to get involved in them. And if there's a ketchup on the floor, you know, I think I'm going to clean that up. If it's a difficult situation at work, and you see the person, you see that the person you need to talk to has a headache and is really kind of unhappy, and you know, you might think, not now. You know, just as opposed to kind of rushing in because you feel certain self-righteousness or something, right? Oh, so you look and see. But so I, probably what I'm saying is a little bit difficult to understand, but I wanted to point to the direction we're going with mindfulness, with awareness practice, to a very special place, time, where the awareness can be aware of anything at all. And in the mindful awareness, there is some kind of freedom there. So I look at the bell here, and I can just see the bell and see it clearly without getting caught up with my desire to have the bell or something. I can feel that sense that the bell is there, and there's space in my mind. There's space around the experience of the bell. There's kind of ease and peace with it. And then my mind goes to the glass of water. Same thing. I can be independent and free of that glass. It's relatively easy to do a glass, right? But you know, there's all kinds of things which are more difficult. But it's possible to turn towards difficult things and learn how to have been mindful of those things and discover a way to be free, not caught in, not agitated by even great difficult things. And so when I was practicing as a monk in Burma, and this is where I was really introduced to this practice I'm teaching you here. I got the instructions that you're getting, but I didn't get this piece. No one told me this piece about you could be aware of everything. And one day I was doing my meditation practice, and it suddenly it dawned on me, I can be mindful. I've learned now how to be mindful of whatever I'm experiencing. And when I'm mindful, I'm free. So in theory, I can be free in the middle of any world experience, any life experience that I'm having. In theory. And when I had that thought, I became so happy. Wow, really? And so then the practice is to discover how to do that, how to bring this kind of mindfulness and be present. And so if we're too interested in improving ourselves, like a self-improvement project, too interested in changing ourselves or changing the world through mindfulness, you can't really get the taste of this freedom that's inherent in the mindfulness or awareness itself. It's okay to want to change yourself, and sometimes it's completely appropriate, and you please go ahead and do it. But at the heart of mindfulness practice is another possibility that we also can move towards, and that is possibility of this freedom in awareness in the midst of whatever is happening. And it doesn't require improving ourselves, changing ourselves. And I might have said this earlier, but I've known a lot of very senior Buddhist practitioners, people who have been doing Buddhist practice for 50 years or more. And one of the remarkable qualities of meeting these people is it turns out they have one or two foibles left. You know, they have little oddities and little things they're afraid of, or little things that make them, you know, angry, or, you know, they have challenges that they say. And you talk to them and say, oh yeah, my practice is to deal with this particular issue of anger I have here, or you know something. But the way they say it, it's like, it's not a problem. They're not troubled by it. They're not at least they're not embarrassed by it. They just say, you know, and there's this freedom, even, you know, so it's not like first and foremost a self-improvement project. It's first and foremost a certain kind of ease and freedom with their foible. And then it's easier to work with things. Does that make some sense? So that's one way of understanding this practice and its potential. Another way is with this analogy that it's a relatively common practice that if someone wants to grow a garden in the spring, they clear the soil, they clear the ground, take away the weeds and whatever is there. And in that, and once it's kind of an open vegetable bed, then they can plant the seed and something can grow. But if it's overgrown with weeds, it's kind of, you plant a seed in, it's not really going to do anything. You have to kind of clear the ground. So the same thing in our minds. If we can clear the weeds in our minds and have the mind kind of be somehow cleared and open, then there are seeds we can plant in it that have a chance to grow and develop. And so part of what we're one of the things we're doing in this mindfulness practice, by not being caught in our thoughts or living in our thoughts, but being able to step back and see it and let things get quiet, is we're kind of clearing the ground to allow for something new to flower, something new to develop and grow. And this is the Buddha talked about the spiritual growth in terms of like a seed that grows and develops as a plant, something that grows and something you want to cultivate and grow. But you have to kind of create the conditions for it to happen. And I say that because many times the authority of what we're thinking and what we're planning and what we're trying to resolve is so strong, and our fantasies and all that are so strong, that some people are unwilling to let go of them or quiet the mind. They seem so important. And so it's a little bit suggesting that as important as your thoughts are, there's real value occasionally to be able to kind of clear the soil so that some other seeds can grow and develop. Or say it, you know, a different way is sometimes, I think usually, if you want to paint a beautiful painting, you start with a blank canvas. And that gives you the most possibility to do something creative. And so the same thing, we're kind of, one of the potentials in this practice as you deepen it, is you kind of end up creating a blank canvas, not so you can just be blank, but so that there's a new possibility that's going to happen. New ways of seeing the world, new ways of seeing ourselves, and new ways of responding, new seeds or new kind of creativity to come out of us. So for this to happen, the mindfulness practice, as we develop it, can show us the freedom part. When mindfulness is coupled with concentration, then it helps the mindfulness, the awareness, to get quieter and kind of clearer. Kind of it clears the air, or clears, like, you know, if you want to see clearly through a dirty window, you clean the window. If you want to see clearly through, you know, through your mind, you know, you want to clear the filter, the dust that's, or the dirt that's in front of you, which is like a lot of the thoughts and beliefs and, you know, fears and all this stuff that's kind of swirling around, has a huge impact on how we see the world. So in a variety of ways, what I'm trying to point to is the idea that it's valuable from time to time, like maybe once a day when you meditate, to be interested in, and to allow the possibility that the mind kind of starts getting quiet. You're kind of making space and clearing things. And in that, perhaps you'll begin to experience the sacredness of an inclusive awareness, the possibility of freedom in the midst of what's happening, and the kind of clarity or the kind of openness or the clearing the field that will allow for something special to kind of grow and develop inside of you. That's, you know, can't if you're claustrophobic with your thoughts and concerns and emotions. Does that make some sense? So one of the, classically in Buddhism, this mindfulness practice, mindfulness meditation that I've been teaching here, is sooner or later is coupled with concentration practice, a practice which helps stabilize and focus and calm the mind. It's not needed for mindfulness. Mindfulness can be done without concentration, but mindfulness becomes a lot stronger when the mind has this concentrated capacity. You know, so what I'd like to do is a little guided meditation, or guided meditation here, where what I'll do is I'm going to review for you in the guided meditation the instructions we've done so far, so you get a sense of the whole, you know, kind of together. And then once we've done that, then I'm going to guide you a little bit in a kind of more of a concentration aspect of doing mindfulness, and perhaps things will get a little bit quieter for you, or if you're not getting quieter, you get a sense of the possibility of getting quieter, maybe because you see how your mind is not quiet, and you can kind of intuit the other side of that. So don't worry if you don't get still or quieter. Maybe you can imagine what's on the other side of that. Is that okay? Okay, so take a comfortable, alert posture. Perhaps sitting a little bit straighter, taller with the spine than you normally would. Because sometimes an alert spine translate to being more alert in the mindfulness. And gently closing your eyes. And taking a few moments to help you arrive, settle in here in your body by taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. As you breathe in, connect to your body. As you breathe out, relax. And then letting your breathing return to normal. And taking a few moments to scan through your body to notice if there's any tension or holding that would be relatively easy to relax. You might be able to soften around the eyes, letting the eyes become quiet. Quiet eyes. Might be possible to soften around the forehead. If the jaws are tight or tense, you could try dropping your mouth open. And once your mouth is dropped open, then float your lips together. And maybe there's a teeny gap between the teeth rather than the usual, maybe clenching. Perhaps there can be softening in the shoulders. Even if you can't relax the shoulders, softening around, relaxing around the tension. And finally, it can be useful to soften around the belly, if it's easy enough to do so, letting the belly hang forward a little bit and maybe letting the pull of gravity settle your belly downward. And then within your body, as part of your body, notice how the body experiences breathing. Perhaps feeling the movement of the belly, or the movements of the chest, or the sensations of the air going in and out through the nostrils. Feeling the rhythm of the body breathing in, the body's experience of breathing out. As you exhale, letting go of your thoughts, and at the same time as letting go of your thoughts, let go into the body breathing. And then in a calm, simple way, let your awareness become aware of the strongest sensation in your body. And as you become aware of it, see if you can have a simple awareness or free awareness that just allows it to be there. But you let it come into focus, feel it clearly, recognize what's happening in your body. And then having acknowledged it and had some awareness of it, you can come back to your breathing. Perhaps welcoming breathing back to awareness. feeling the rhythm of breathing in and breathing out, and resting on that rhythm with awareness. And in a calm, simple way, notice how you're feeling. Maybe the predominant emotion or mood that you're in. Doesn't have to be anything strong. It could be that you're somewhat calm or peaceful. Or maybe you're impatient. Whatever way your feeling's okay, but take a few moments to do mindfulness of your emotion. See if the mindfulness can be free enough of it that you can just know it for itself without making it complicated. As if how you feel is allowed to be there. In whatever way your mood, your emotion is, recognize what it is and perhaps feel it as it shows itself in your body. No need to think about it. Accompany your emotional state with awareness of the emotion in your body. And then calmly begin again with your breathing. Feel your breathing in your body. And for the next few breaths, ride your breaths with a quiet awareness. With that part of your awareness that feels quiet. And then calmly and simply become aware of thinking, if you are thinking, without making it a problem. But in a sense, step away from it to be independent of what you're thinking. So you have the ability to see, recognize clearly, oh, this is thinking. This is a thought. This is just a thought. And if the thought is strong, thinking is strong, you might notice the physicality of that thinking or the emotionality of it in a simple way. Just know it. Not a problem to fix. And then begin again with your breathing. And as you feel the body breathing, see if there can be a quiet or a still awareness of breathing. So the knowing of the awareness of the simple act of breathing is not agitated, not pushing, not searching. A simple awareness. If there is thinking going on, perhaps you can let the thoughts recede to the perimeter. And so the center of your attention is with your breathing. So at the center of attention, there's a quiet awareness. Or awareness that has a quality of stillness that quietly and stays connected to the body breathing. If sensations of your body or emotions or thoughts become compelling, see if you can turn your mindfulness to be aware of these compelling experiences, to recognize them, to be aware, but to do so with a still and quiet awareness. Just be there to see. A little bit the focus is cultivating a stillness in the mind, a quiet in the mind, as you're aware of breath, body, emotions and thoughts, sounds. Stepping away from your thoughts. So you're not living in your thoughts. If you're living in awareness of what's happening. So you can see what's happening with a quiet, clear awareness. Perhaps, if it's possible, relaxing any agitation in your mind. Or perhaps you can discover the kind of relaxation that comes when you simply accept what's here, and know it in awareness. No matter what your experience is, whether it's easy or difficult, no matter what it is, can you know it? Can you be aware of it? For about one more minute, we'll sit here. Simple awareness of what is. And then to come out of the meditation, you can take a few long, slow, deep breaths. As you breathe in, feel your body. Feel your chair, the floor, your cushion. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. So one of the purposes of doing concentration, bringing it together with mindfulness, is so the mind becomes still and quiet. But some people associate stillness and quiet and silence with being silenced and being kind of frozen or being dismissed and kind of ignored or something. And the kind of stillness and quiet that we can discover within is nothing like that. It's more like, at least I associated with early morning dawn over a peaceful kind of mountain lake. It's really quiet and still, but nothing's been silenced. Nothing is kind of held, you know, unmoving. And there's, you know, lots of potential for sounds to come and movement to happen and for things to appear and occur. But it feels so pristine to have the still and the quiet with, you know, with the whole world ready to kind of show itself. And so one of the ways of developing this kind of concentration of a still, quiet, focused mind is to give, in mindfulness meditation, the way I've taught it, is to give priority to mindfulness of breathing. So within reason, to give a little more emphasis on staying with the breath. And first maybe you can stay with 4 breaths or 5 breaths, but you can see if you can linger and hang in there and develop the ability to stay with more 10, 15, 20. You don't have to count, but to kind of stay, extend how long. And as you give yourself over to the breathing, as you allow that experience to kind of fill you, just breathing, becoming aware, see if you can become aware with a quiet mind, a still mind, as opposed to thinking about your breathing or evaluating or judging your breathing or, you know, manipulating or analyzing it. Just quiet, just be there. If there's other things that are really compelling, body sensations, emotions, thoughts, sounds, you could always turn towards it if you start feeling some real pull to pay attention there, to bring your attention there. They're really tugging at you. But otherwise, unless you get a clear signal, like I need to pay attention to my body sensations or to my emotions, one way to develop concentration is to keep going, being mindful of the breathing. Just stay there. Stay there. But you don't force yourself to stay there if there's something else that's really grabbing your attention, because then you turn your attention to that other thing, and then you try to have the still, quiet attention on that. Just be there for a while. In a sense, get focused on that. And then when it's no longer compelling, or it's been acknowledged, or it's gone away, then you come back to your breathing. And if you want to cultivate more concentration with that, then you try to just give a little bit more emphasis on staying there. Don't quickly leave it for something else that comes along. Let the other things be kind of in the periphery and just stay with your breathing. Does that make sense? So I said in this course that as you're understanding how to be with your breathing, it becomes easier then to do mindfulness of the body. As you understand how to be mindfulness of your bodily experience, it's easier to do mindfulness of emotions. As you're more familiar with how to be mindful of your emotions, easier to be mindful of your thinking. As you become mindful of all this together in your thinking, then you start discovering that there's other things happening, other ways of knowing, being aware, being present, that doesn't require thinking and doesn't require having a feeling about things. And then as you get more concentrated, some of the thoughts get quieter and quieter. You're not thinking so actively. And so one of the things you might be doing is you might stop telling yourself stories about what's going on or what's happening in your life. And your stories might be fine stories to have. They might be very entertaining, or they might be the opposite, but they're certainly compelling. But as a story, you know, for a little while you get a vacation. The story is kind of quiet down and gets still. And so it's kind of nice not to be seeing things through a story. You know, it's your valuation, your idea. And so that kind of activity of the mind gets quieter. And as the mind gets quieter, one of the things that gets quieter is the tendency to always have a concept about things, an idea of what it is. Because that's a mental activity. And to discover, to be present for something without some of these more concepts that we often bring along is very freeing and gives us a different perspective of what's happening. So I'll give you an example of kind of the... And this is what brings wisdom. One of the ways that wisdom arises through this practice. So I'll give you a little example. So I have this leaf here from a little garden outside our house. And as I hold it up this way, just a leaf, green leaf. I don't know, 6 inches tall or something. And great, it's a leaf by itself. Nice. And you see maybe the suchness of the leaf, just a leaf in and of itself. Nice. But now, I could do a little magic trick where you get to see the hand movement, how it works. Oh, this, so first you see this. So now I can say something that is I couldn't say before. Now I can say the leaf I had before is the big leaf. And the leaf that's in my other hand is the small leaf. It's pretty simple, right? But now here's the magic trick, okay? So this is the big one, right? You agree? Right? Look, watch. So what happened? Now the big one is the small one. Wow. Did you catch that, or did I do that too fast? So, big and small does not live in the leaf, does not belong to the leaf. The leaf in and of itself is neither big nor small, it's just a leaf. It becomes big or small when the mind compares it to something else. The leaf is not comparing itself to anything, it just is. So that's a simple thing, but the mind's tendency to compare is an activity of the mind. The mind is engaged, working to make that comparison. It's not a very demanding job. It's pretty simple. We do it kind of almost habitually or automatically, but it's still, the mind is working. As we stop, either with the thinking and conceiving mind quiets down in meditation, or we see very clearly that the mind is making the comparison, then it's possible to start seeing the leaf without the comparison and see it for what it is in and of itself. It doesn't matter too much about leaves, but it can matter a lot about yourself. Because a lot of human suffering arises because of comparative thinking. And just if you just consider, I think for most people, if you consider your physical body, I think a majority of people have something about their body that, in comparison to others, is not really up to snuff. Their hair is too long, too short, too little, too much. I was very concerned about the length of my forehead from my top of my nose to my hairline when I was in, I guess, seventh grade. And I was very busy in seventh grade measuring in class, because, you know, class, not much happening in these classes. So there was lots of time to measure. So I would take my finger and put it like this and kind of measure, because I was concerned that it was receding. And so I got a very good sense of, you know, how to measure it this way, and because that was really important. Or also, I think it was in seventh grade, it was also, I would sit in class and I'd pull my hair, because it had been, I was away from California, summer of 1967, those of you who knew what happened then. And when I came back, having long hair was like a thing to do for boys. So I thought if I pulled it, and there's an interesting story, I think. Maybe. So I was living in Italy, that the 66, 67, and around that time. And I did have longer hair than any boy in Italy. So I was a little bit hip. And also, I was a little bit hip because I had blue jeans. And I was the only boy in Italy who had blue jeans back then, seemingly, at least in that small town I was in. And so I was cool. And I would go around a little town I was lived in, kind of feel a little bit, you know, like happy about myself. You know, because I was with it. And then end of the summer, I flew back to Los Angeles. And as I said, a lot happened in the summer of 67. And a lot happened to my friends. My friends had discovered to let their hair grow longer. And now my hair wasn't long anymore in comparison. And also they discovered what you could do, the interesting things you can do with your blue jeans. You could, wash them 50 times. You could bleach them. I had friends who put their blue jeans on the road so cars would drive over them. And I just had blue jeans. So I became deflated. I had been inflated in Italy and deflated in Los Angeles. And all that really changed was I compared myself to new people. So there's all these, but what is the hairline in and of itself? Is it a problem? You know, does the hairline compare itself? What's it like to experience myself, my hair, for example, in the suchness of myself, just the simplicity of what I am, without the comparison? When these comparisons are causing suffering for ourselves or to others, to allow ourselves to experience ourselves without the comparisons can be a great relief. It can be a gift to ourselves, where we allow ourselves just to be who we are. And from the inside out, meaning inside out, meaning how we feel as opposed to the concepts and ideas that we overlay on us ourselves, there's often a lot fewer problems than we realize. There was someone who said, I don't know who it was, I've had a lot of problems in my life. Most of them never happened. Concepts and ideas and stories we tell ourselves. So part of the wisdom, one piece of the wisdom in Buddhism, is as the mind gets quieter and we can see clearly, we see the role that these concepts and ideas have in our life, and we start putting a question mark next to them. Do I have to live in them? Do I have to believe in them? We might also begin realizing I can experience myself in my life without these concepts, ideas. There's a whole other way of being here. And for some people, that's like a whole new world to walk into, because the concepts we've been living in, the stories we've been living in, are so thick. And so to clear the mind, to clear the window of the mind of all these thoughts and ideas, it can be a phenomenal gift for people who have been suffering under, for example, comparative thinking, or expectations, or ideas of should, or shouldn't, all kinds of things. And so to quiet down. So there's a lot of wisdom, a lot of understanding can come simply because we're able to see more clearly. We can see from that quiet mind. We see the difference, what's going on. So the wisdom of Buddhism is in itself can arises out of not thinking about things or analyzing things or reading books about things, but a lot of the deepest wisdom we can come surfaces almost by itself in a quiet mind. And a quiet mind that's able to see clearly. Not a quiet mind that's turned off and not noticing, just kind of checked out. But a quiet mind that really sees, is present for our life as it's being lived. And it's kind of like, getting a blank, it's kind of like having this flower bed or vegetable bed that's cleared, and some of the most beautiful seeds that are in there can germinate in that openness. So in addition to wisdom, a clear, present mindfulness of our experience, with a kind of the clarity, the quietness of it, is usually the ideal circumstance to allow for some of the beautiful qualities of the human heart to grow. A busy, claustrophobic mind, a mind that's full of shoulds and expectations and comparisons and not good enough and wanting more or all this stuff, that's a recipe for more weeds to grow. And those are weeds, in a sense, and then they seed themselves and more weeds grow. So as we get quieter and the weeds not there, there are seeds inside of us of compassion, of love, of generosity, of equanimity, of kindness, of wisdom, of joy, of happiness, they're kind of just waiting to kind of be able to sprout. And one of the remarkable things about this practice as it deepens is that you don't have to engineer the results of it. And in fact, you're better off not trying to get results from the practice. That's just more concepts and ideas. It's just more, that's more weeds. And oddly enough, spending too much time wanting results gets in the way of the results. So the idea is to try to be really simple. Be here with what is, and explore, develop, cultivate slowly over time, getting a little bit better at a time. It's not all or nothing. The ability to have this clear, quiet, maybe silent, luminously silent, awareness of the breathing, of the body, of emotions, of thoughts, of the world around you. And you'll discover wisdom, and you'll discover something really wonderful that can grow and develop inside of you. It's a wonderful thing. So, to bring mindfulness together with a concentration is a classic Buddhist thing to do. And there's a variety of ways to do it. I mentioned already just kind of giving more emphasis on the breathing. So you're really mostly, the more you can do one thing, the easier it is to cultivate the concentration. Let go of your thoughts, the easiest thoughts to let go of, and keep staying with the breath, keep coming back. Try to stay there. But with, you know, complete mindfulness practice, you don't hang on to that. You can let go of that at any moment to bring mindfulness to these other things. Another way of doing it is to, which is a big part of our particular meditation tradition, is to do meditation retreats. And we call them retreats. It could be half-day retreats. We have them here at IMC. The half-day means 9:30 to 12:15, where you practice more consistently through over a longer period of time. The continuity of practice develops concentration. Then we have longer retreats. We have day-long retreats here. And so the continuity through the whole day also tends to create the kind of calming, focusing, stilling quality that brings the concentration in together with the mindfulness. And then we have, and other groups like us, have residential retreats where people will go for 2, 3 days, 7 days, 14 days, sometimes a month at a time, to go into a silent residential meditation retreat where everything is there to take care of you, so you can really kind of delve into this quiet, deeper, intimate world of that comes when mindfulness and concentration are joined together. And so, especially if you go on a longer retreat, the first day is you bring the world with you. You know, all your thoughts and concerns and he said, she said, and you know, how could they, and you know, I have to fix my problems, and you know, all kinds of politics, you know. And as the days goes along, those concerns fall away. They become distant. And then the agitation of that goes away, and then there's kind of intimacy and clarity by being here that supports the deepening of this wisdom, of the deepening of this flowering of something inside that's quite special. The other thing that develops concentration is practicing regularly in your daily life, meaning if you meditate every day, you start having a continuity. And concentration is developed through continuity. So every day you meditate for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, something at some length of time that works for you. And pretty much you do that day after day. And after a while, your body, your system gets the hang of it. It becomes easier and easier to settle in. And you know, when someone who's a good swimmer wants to develop their swimming, they'll go in the pool and swim with the same stroke 10,000 times, 100,000 times, just over and over again. And they develop their swimming by they refining their stroke imperceptibly, a little bit, kind of. They almost don't have to think about it sometimes, I believe. It's just like somehow the system feels into what's more efficient. So by sitting every day and kind of being mindful of what's going on, your whole system will begin to kind of have that refinement and development and grow and kind of settle in and learn how to be concentrated and present. So if you're interested in bringing concentration together with the mindfulness, this is one way to do it. The other thing, way of developing mindfulness beyond doing the simple meditation practice, doing it there, is to practice mindfulness in daily life. And some people actually find that it's actually more beneficial for them to start using some of these ideas that I've been teaching this class in their daily life. And it's great to do both, in meditation and outside. So that, when you middle of your daily life, you take a few moments to be mindful of what's happening. Rather than thinking about what's happening or thinking about something else, what's happening right now? So, for example, for a long time, I would, when the telephone would ring, I would not answer the phone right away. It was kind of interesting because, at least for me, there seemed to be this biological compulsion feeling that something terrible would happen if I didn't answer the phone with the least amount of rings. But most people don't hang up quickly. And so I learned to wait two or three or four rings, and I would use that time to check in with myself, to be mindful. Sometimes I noticed my breathing and could feel actually for some reason my breathing was being held or tight, and I'd relax my breathing. Sometimes I noticed my shoulders were tense, not because the phone was ringing, just because I was, and I'd relax my shoulders or my belly. Sometimes I noticed that I was kind of preoccupied by something, and I thought, oh, I think that's good, I know that, because I'm going to change gears to be on the phone. And in two or three rings, I would go through, be mindful and notice, and I found that the quality of my answering the phone and being present was so much improved because I took the time to check in and be mindful of what was going on. And then I could be more mindful for the conversation. And sometimes I noticed if I didn't do that, sometimes I was still concerned with the thing I was doing and not quite with the conversation. Some people will find at times in their daily life just to take a few, a minute, 30 seconds to be mindful of their breathing. If you're waiting for something, I think, if people are really honest with what they're doing in their minds, chances are that if 30 seconds or a minute of mindfulness of breathing is probably a better option. You come to a red light. You can be impatient and glare at the person in front of you or ride your brake and your gas pedal at the same time or all kinds of wonderful things. Or check your phone. All right? Or you can use that minute to just be mindful, check in, be here, breathe, feel your breathing, find out. Standing in line at the grocery store, I do it. I'm standing in line waiting. I could read the National Enquirer, the headlines, or I could be mindful. I've discovered that I'm actually a better person when I stand there and check in with myself and be mindful than if I get interested in the headlines of National Enquirer. So there's all kinds of things that I'm better off doing. I'm often better off doing just checking in and being here. And then I find that the quality of my attention as I go forward into my life is richer and better. So I found that for a long time I would do all kinds of things in the day that I used as mindfulness reminders. And when I saw those things or heard those things or encountered those things, I would use that for a few moments to check in with myself. What's happening now? What's happening here? So because of how I was trained in the Zen monasteries, they have a... I won't tell you why, but from that training, I made a habit for a long time. Whenever I went through a door frame, I would use that as a time to check in with myself, to be mindful. Not just myself, I keep saying myself, but it's also mindful of the environment where I'm going, like going through a door frame and going into a new space. Instead of being lost in thought, let's be here for it and see it. Some people... we'll put a little sticky, dots or something on light switches or different things or on their phone or on different things they're going to encounter through the day. And when they see that little dot, oh, breathe, check in, know what's happening. I've known people who put a bell on that goes off automatically every hour, every half an hour. And when they hear that bell, they stop and take a minute to breathe and be mindful and be present. It's great to check in. Many people discover they have that little 1 minute break to check in. They discover that what they were doing, how they were going about their life, wasn't really that ideal. They were a little bit more tense, a little bit preoccupied, a little bit caught up in something. And by having a little reminder to check in, there could be a little course correction and start over again and maybe be a little bit different way. And what I found was slowly over time that it became more and more of a habit to be mindful as I went through my daily life. As I was walking through the city, I would be more aware of myself, the environments, not lost in my thoughts. And the city, the whole experience became more richer for me, nicer. And I kind of tended to stay closer to some place of wisdom, of calmness, of openness, of receptivity in a great way. And then, you know, in conversations and working, and you know, it was a beautiful thing. And then what I discovered is that, for myself, is that the more I could practice mindfulness in my daily life, the easier it was to settle into the meditation. The more I settled into my meditation, the more I was inclined to be mindful in my daily life. And there was a wonderful reciprocity that built up, that kind of supported each other and built over time. And so these are some of the ways that you can develop your practice beyond just simple mindfulness meditation. You can focus on developing a concentrated mind, so the mindfulness is more concentrated. You can, and with that comes greater access to wisdom and clarity about what's going on. And you could also practice mindfulness in daily life. And it's very rewarding to do that, to explore that whole territory. I'll say one more thing about daily life practice. Is, if you're inclined to do this, is take one ordinary activity that you do, maybe every day, and for 1 week, while you do that, experiment with being present and mindful for the activity while you're doing it, as opposed to doing it and you're thinking about other things and preoccupied. So it could be as simple as brushing your teeth. For 1 week, you're going to brush your teeth and really kind of be there for brushing your teeth. And if your mind wanders off, come back to teeth. Mind wanders off, come back to teeth. If then you find that you're impatient with coming back to your teeth because it's so boring and you're, you know, be mindful of boredom. Be mindful of impatience. Come back to your teeth. Just kind of be there. And for 1 week. And the next week, choose something else. Maybe it's cleaning your breakfast dishes, whatever way you do that. The next week, maybe it's the drive to work. The next week, maybe it's the walk from the parking lot to where you work. Another week, it's eating lunch. Maybe you choose to eat it. For 1 week, you choose a meal a day to eat in silence. No radio, no TV. Maybe you don't know talking to anyone unless it seems unfriendly. And just kind of do mindfulness of eating. Just be present for eating and nothing else. So choose different things. And the hope is that after a while, you get the hang of it, that you enjoy it. You find it really nice. And maybe it's not so long that it's not onerous. And over time, you start having the experience of all the little pieces of your life, daily life. It's kind of like becomes more automatic or easy, or you're familiar with it in a different way, and you tend to kind of almost naturally find yourself more attentive, more present for these different things because you spent a week doing it. And over time, you start filling in the day. And the day becomes probably much calmer, more peaceful, because it's one thing to use meditation to calm and relax the stresses of the life, of daily life. Many people associate meditation and do it because they want to reduce stress. It's actually wiser to not get stressed to begin with. And actually it's much more efficient. you know, way of living. And so if you can start practicing mindfulness in daily life and really track what's going on as you go through your life and stop and take a look and have these different activities where you're more present for them as you do it, you'll start noticing, becoming wiser about what you're doing when you get stressed, when you get tight, when you get anxious, when you start striving or resisting or tightening up or whatever it is. You start seeing how that works. You see how that magic trick works. Because many times people don't know quite why they're stressed. But as you get more and more mindful through the daily life, you start seeing the seeds of stress. You start seeing the beginnings of it. And you're better off, better able to kind of not continue that. Just relax right then and there. Then when you come to do your meditation, meditation's not just about coping with the stress and getting relaxing to some calm baseline. You're kind of at your baseline, and then meditation gets even more interesting because, you know, you don't need to de-stress. You can go into deeper realms, deeper inner intimacy, deeper connections to our life that can't, you know, that begin to unfold when the stress is no longer there. So those are my thoughts, kind of an overview perhaps of these weeks and kind of how to go forward from here. We can take a couple of minutes, maybe for two or three questions or comments about any of this now. I've carried on a long monologue. Anything you want to ask about the meditation we did or about what I said or ask for clarification about any of the instructions. Go ahead.
I wasn't mindful enough drinking. So, I think the way you asked the question, which is a fine way, I don't want to limit freedom to just freedom from reactivity. And it's, I think it's a bigger domain. But certainly, it's freedom from reactivity. Reactivity meaning kind of being on automatic pilot, just without us choosing, or just something moves through us, we act impulsively. Sorry?
So what are the other freedoms?
So I think of reactivity, if I don't know how people use the word, but you react to something in the moment. Some people, and so you can be reactively angry or reactively desirous and grab something or something, reactively afraid. Some people are chronically afraid. They're not reacting. They're just, that's their baseline. That's how they are. Some people are, you know, it's pervasive in their life that they're aversive. It's like a mood almost. So they're not being reactive, they just are. And so there's also that, we drop away. And then the other thing is, so in Buddhism, the core task of mindfulness in the Buddhist context is not a religious goal. So you don't have to, even though I'm talking about Buddhism now, you don't have to be afraid. The it turns out that the ultimate purpose of mindfulness in Buddhism is not to cling to anything, not to get attached, not to hold on. And that raises a lot of, you know, challenging questions for people who hear this idea. Isn't it okay to be attached? Isn't it okay to cling? You know, shouldn't I be clinging to my children? Shouldn't I be clinging to all kinds of things? And so that's an interesting thing to consider and work with and maybe work the edges of. In a sense, what I mean by that is maybe work with freeing yourself from the clinging that makes sense to let go of. And if you have doubts about that it's appropriate or you should let go, you know, let go of clinging to certain things, just wait. In your own time, you might discover something interesting or wise about it. And in your own time, you might discover that actually there might be better alternatives than clinging. So the ultimate freedom in Buddhism is freedom from clinging. Maybe one more question? It's all good? Well, I hope that what I've taught during these weeks, I guess 1 week I was gone and Tom covered for me, so what we've taught these weeks, hopefully is something that's useful for you. And what are the ideas, kind of a few ideas in offering this class, what I'm trying to do. One is to say a few things with enough clarity or ways that are memorable that you don't necessarily remember everything, but there's a few ideas, few approaches to mindfulness, few kind of metaphors or few kind of ideas that maybe you'll find useful through your life. So the other thing I want to try to get across, especially in the early weeks, this idea that you can't do it wrong. If you feel like I'm doing it wrong, or this is too difficult, I'm not up to it, think about the story about the leaves. You've just got involved in comparative thinking, in more complicated concepts than you had to do. There's no need to kind of really think that you're doing it wrong, just as there's no need to think that you're doing it right. And just do it. And it'll have its challenges, for sure. But I think any spiritual practice that's not challenging is not worth much. So don't be afraid it's difficult or challenging. A lot of the benefit comes from just doing it and doing it consistently or doing it regularly and applying it and applying it. And, you know, and if it's difficult at times, I would encourage you just to be content. Oh, now it's going to work. Now I'm up against something that's useful. And then let's just keep going and work with it. And when it's not difficult, be content. Because it's not difficult, it's nice to do it. And when it's neither difficult nor not difficult, be content. Just be content. Practice contentedly. It's a great path. It's a great endeavor, this is what we're doing here. So lastly, one of the ways of it's hard sometimes to do this practice alone. Sometimes people have challenge with discipline. Sometimes it's just too weird. People around us at work or people maybe in our home, they just think it's weird and there's not much support for it. And you don't want to be the only weird person around. So sometimes coming to a meditation center where other people are weird in the same way, it can make you feel, you know, like, okay, normalize it, make it seem, it's okay, other people are doing this. One of the interesting things that happens when people do this practice over time, there's a very strong tendency to become more ethical. And then sometimes it's actually hard for people to go to work, for example, one of the common complaints people have or stories people have is that after doing this practice for a while, they're not interested in the office gossip anymore. But the office gossip is kind of like how people connect. And so they don't want to do it anymore. So how do they find their way? So their tendency to become more ethical. So sometimes it's helpful to be around these other people who are kind of, their values are changing to be more ethical. So again, so you don't feel like you're getting weird, you know, because you don't want to gossip or don't want to do different things. And also practicing with other people, even by osmosis, being in the room with other people who are meditating, there's a learning that happens in the presence of other people, a kind of a sense of strength, the presence, the example of other people that just kind of we pick up kind of by, you know, even subconsciously we pick it up. That's how I can be. That's how I can sit. That's how I can bring this into my life. All kinds of ways. So there's a lot of benefits. And then also if someone like a teacher is giving a talk that's about the practice or related to it, maybe it's inspiring. And it kind of gives you a new idea. And you, oh, yeah. Then you're good for a week. You're like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of inspired and I like to do it. And then you get a little boost next week or something. So if you're interested in this, one of the ways to be supported to do it is to find a meditation group that you can join and be part of. And there's lots of them around that you can find and, you know, in your community neighborhood. If you live in a place where there's nothing nearby, the Quakers are having their silent meetings. It's pretty cool. They'll let you come and be silent with them. You don't have to speak. Sit there and just, you know, some people find it very nice to meditate with the Quakers. We have a few different groups associated with us around the peninsula, or I think on our website it has a list of them. And you're always welcome to come here. IMC is kind of designed to be we try to be at least kind of a relaxed, somewhat casual place to come and go. We are aware that people living an urban life, like many people live here, that people's lives are busy, engaged, and we don't want it to be, we'd like to just make it easier for people to come and leave as they see fit, and come late, leave early, come late and leave early. it is to be somewhat, you know, relaxed and easy, so it's easy for us in this life to come and benefit from whatever we have here. And you're all welcome to come here, and if you come regularly, there's a sense of community that builds with people who are here, and some people find that very supportive, and that we have a wide array of programs that we do that support people at different levels of experience and engagement in the practice, and so you kind of get a sense of what the lay of the land is and come to whatever is interesting for you. Almost everything we do here is completely open, and everything we do here is freely given, and so there's, you know, no, shouldn't be any financial barrier to come, because we normally never ask for money, even. But for those of you who might support the teachers or me or the center by that box out there, we're very grateful. And when I say the word we, I don't mean the in-group here. I mean everyone who comes here and practices. Because the idea here at IMC is that we don't want to have this idea of us versus them. We're all volunteers here. And everyone who comes here who helps take care of the place is not only a volunteer but a practitioner. So we're all practitioners together. And even if you come here for the first time, the idea is, the hope is that we can all be we. And so we're very grateful that this, you know, that there's support and capacity to have this kind of thing. It's kind of remarkable. So thank you for coming to this class, and if you're always welcome to come. Thank you.